Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Welcome back to XYZ, the CNC podcast. For anybody into CNC machining or whatever it may be, hosted by myself, Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives, and Aaron Goff of Goff Customs, also a knife maker. But this isn't necessarily for knife makers. Anybody with any sort of interest in CNCing or machining, that kind of thing. How are you, Aaron? It's been 2 weeks since we last... Well, over a week since we last spoke.
Yeah, no, going good, mate. It's been a very good week, actually. I hit a bit of a milestone on Monday, which I'm
Your
excited
millionth
about.
Sale.
I wish. I received an order for a knife. I assembled and finished the knife and shipped it on the same day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. So, like, obviously I had parts and stuff already made, like a sheath and blade and so on, but machined the handle scales and did final fitting and assembly and, yeah, shipped the same day. And then the customer received it the next day.
Wow, that's Amazon Prime stuff, that is.
Right? I was like, holy shit, this is... next level, you know?
That is impressive.
How about you, mate?
I haven't had the best of times, to be honest with you. I've been sick to the point of I've barely been in my shop for the last, I'd say, 10 days.
Right.
First, started off with what was a migraine, which I've never really had before. But, you know, I've had headaches and thought, oh, this is a really bad headache. Yeah. This thing took me down. It was pretty bad.
Yeah, they can be pretty incapacitating.
Yeah, and to the point where it hurts to open your eyes. It was that bad. So I was a few days in bed with that. Got up out of bed on the day I thought I was feeling good. And you know when you've sort of been cooped up and you're like a cage tiger, you're excited to work, you can't wait.
Yep.
But I managed to then pull a muscle in my sort of neck going into my back, really. And this was worse pain than the migraine. This took me back down again into bed for another few days. And the last few days, technically, there's been nothing wrong with me. I'm just tired.
Like, yeah.
Completely tired. There's just so much going on at the moment. And there's not much headspace left. I'm full to the brim. And just constantly tired. But things. The weather's changing. Spring has come in. Hopefully I'll have more energy soon. But I've just had the wind taken out of my sails the last, I'd say, probably 10 days.
Yeah,
so it's
going
to be... I'm taking it slowly to get back into stuff. So I've started a few things this morning and, I'm fine. I am fine, but I'm just tired now.
Well, here's to a better week. Knock on wood.
Yes, let's hope so. Let's hope so. So let's go back to this knife that you managed to ship the next day. Is that something that you think you're aiming for now? Because like you said, your knives are the same each time. The differences are, the handle materials or the liners or the sheaths now. Having a bunch in stock and being able to do that, that would be pretty sweet, wouldn't it? It takes a lot of stress.
Yeah, it does take a lot of stress. And that's kind of the primary reason why I wanted to... It's not necessarily a goal to be like, finishing them up the same day, but like, I'd like to keep some common colors in stock, like have them already done. And then, less common stuff, I'd like to be, getting it out within a week or so. It just like kind of burns my brain when I have like a big backlog of work. It's a pretty amazing feeling to be like totally caught up and be like, oh, there's a snowstorm outside today. Fuck it, I'm not going to go to work, like I'll work another day or whatever, like having that flexibility is really nice.
Yeah, like a big weight lifted off the shoulders, I bet.
Yes, and I've been trying to work to that point for like 5 years or like 6 years. It's been a really long journey. So yeah, pretty crazy to be there.
Nice. I did see the knife that you made, and it had the, was it the green handle with the blue liners or the blue handle with the green?
Very line? Jeff Fader style, right?
That's exactly what I thought when I saw it. Because he's got this sort of house style, if you like. And that was very similar, yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, because that was a customer request. So it was, royal blue scales with toxic green liners. And I didn't put two and two in my head together in my head when he ordered that. I wasn't like, oh, that, you know, that's kind of Jeff's kind of colors, you know? And then as soon as I saw it in person, I was like, that looks like, you know, one of Jeff's knives. So yeah, I thought that was funny. But that was his request. He was like, I know this will sound crazy, but...
Yeah. So it wasn't Jeff who ordered it?
No.
To be clear. Okay. No. Okay, that's good. Okay. But I understand, I haven't seen it. I can just see in the notes here that you've put out a new video this week.
Yes, sir.
Talking about bolt screws, thrust bearings, that kind of thing. I haven't even looked at YouTube for maybe 2 weeks.
I watch way too much YouTube these days. I find like a lot of the content elsewhere just kind of boring, like movies and TV shows. Yeah. So I just watch YouTube for entertainment, honestly.
Yeah. Well, normally me too, but...
It's been that week.
Let's say I've had a different 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, so like I actually filmed the video last April, like all, and I've only just had a chance to finish editing it and so on. So like I had an issue with the Z axis on my Fidal right after I started trying to use it. This was the one that I had rebuilt in a previous video, and somehow I'd missed like 3/1000ths of an inch of backlash in the Z axis. So yeah, I'm not sure what happened there, but basically I put together a video, explaining what a ball screw is, what a thrust bearing is, all the possible causes of the backlash, how to diagnose where it's coming from, and then fixing it.
That's going to be very handy for a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope so. I tried to like, it's really hard to make a technical video like that that's still watchable, you know, and I think luckily I hit the sweet spot, but yeah, it was like I literally cut like 95% of what I filmed.
Right. Oh, geez. Okay. Yeah. So a lot of effort goes into these videos.
Something here. Like that. My average video is at least 8 hours of editing. Usually closer to 16.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jush. So are you doing sort of multiple cameras as well then?
No, just one camera. But like I'm, you know, I'll be. I might. You know, so sometimes I'll have like, you know, 300 gig, 500 gig of footage for a single video.
Oh, wow. Oof.
It can be pretty nuts. But I mean, luckily I've been able to keep it a bit more sane recently. I'm just kind of like focusing a bit more on taking less footage. And previously I had an iMac. So I buy all my computers used. I hate buying new computers. So I had an older iMac at the shop. I had an older iMac at home. But it meant that, like, if I took footage at the shop, then I had to bring SD cards home to put them on my computer. And then I could only edit them at home, blah, blah, blah. So late last year, I bought a 2015 MacBook Pro. And I've just been, like, dumping. And I put a 2 terabyte SSD in it, which is amazing. So I've just been dumping footage onto it as soon as I take it, and then I can kind of chop it up real quick, and it's helped smooth my workflow out a lot. So
yeah, and they were probably the last of the good MacBook Pros. So that one before the touch bar and all the rest of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it has standard USB ports and an SD card reader, and yeah, like the new ones don't have an SD card reader. Like, you know, like half of the people that would consider themselves pros that are using Macs are like graphic designers or photographers or video editors. Like,
they need that IO to get things. Yeah,
yeah, I'd really definitely like an SD card reader.
Yeah, well, I had the 2012 MacBook Pro, mm-hmm. and I had that for 8 years, and it was bulletproof. It was just the best thing. It said all the ports that I needed. It was fast, but in the end, it just I can't quite remember what happened. It probably. Now, here's the thing. I know exactly what happened.
He dropped it
my
in the toilet.
My wife would take it in the bathroom with her when she had a bath.
Oh.
To watch Netflix. And steam, over the years, a lot of steam had got in and stuff had corroded. So it had its day. But now I've got one of the new MacBook Pros with a touch bar. And I just don't like it. It's, you know, it's slightly thinner and all these things that they, you know, and the bezels less around the screen, all these things that they sort of promote. But I'm having to use dongles for virtually everything. There's no SD card reader, and it's
no MagSafe adapter.
And the what, sorry?
The MagSafe, the power adapter, the magnetic power adapter.
Well, that's gone. Now I've got, now it's USB-C.
That thing has saved my laptop a few times where I like accidentally kicked the power cord, you know, and that would have like, you know, probably dropped the laptop on the ground and smashed it, but instead just comes unhooked, you know, like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So I bought one of these used off Kijiji. It was like $900 or something. And then
is that a made up word?
Kijiji. It's
Kijiji.
It's Craigslist except by eBay, and it's taken over in Canada.
Okay.
Do you know Craigslist? You started it. You should know.
I know. Yeah, I know of it, but we don't have it over here. We didn't have it in the UK either. I think it's an American thing. Yeah.
And Craigslist used to be the thing in Canada too, but then Kijiji, which is owned by eBay, they started this like huge marketing campaign, and within a year they took over.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between that and eBay? Is it more like Facebook Marketplace, that kind of thing? Is it?
Yeah, it's just face to face sales, cash. Dodgy deals on the sidewalk.
Cash is king.
Yeah, you open your coat, you take out a MacBook, you know. Speaking of buying things.
So what kind of stuff are you buying on?
Well, that's what I was just about to say. I had an experience with this bloody Muppet the other day. I've been looking for a lathe. And we talked about this a little bit in the past because I want to do this ISO 20 spindle project, right? So... I have to make prototypes, and that means I need a lathe. And I thought I'd found a great lathe. It was a Colchester Student, which was made in the 60s lathe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this guy, you know, didn't know what he had, and he was just like, best offer. And I was like, okay, how much do you want for it? And he's like, $600. I'm like, fuck yeah, buddy. Like, let's do it. Like, I said, you know, can you deliver it? And he's like, oh, I guess so. I've got a tow truck. I was like, this is perfect. Like, getting delivery here would be like $1,000, right? So I was like, how much do you want for delivery? Like $300? And he's like, oh, call it $200. I was like, okay, this is working out to be the deal of the century. And then he went quiet for a day, and I was like, hey, mate, do you, you know, like, when are you delivering the lathe? Because we'd talked about it, like, as far as I knew, it was mine. And he's like, oh, it's gone. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, oh, I sold it to another guy for $750. And I was like, buddy, I would have given you like $1,500 for that lathe. Like, you're a dummy, you know?
Oh, seriously. What a chancer.
I know. So, but that's fine. All's well that ends well. I ended up putting a wanted post on Practical Machinist, and a guy kind of close to me has a standard modern lathe, which is a very nice manual lathe from, I think it's like early 80s, late 70s.
Right.
And it's a 13 by 40 inch lathe. So, what, 40 centimeters by 100?
Okay. Yeah.
So it's a fair bit bigger. It's about 5 feet long. And nice. Yeah, that's going to be coming this weekend.
Oh, lovely, lovely. And that's all ready to go. Is that a full strip down, or is it just ready to go?
I've got no idea, honestly. I don't have a car, so I can't drive. And this guy is an older gentleman that doesn't use technology. I'm going to be seeing
sketch
it
for you. Sketch
pretty much. I'm going to be seeing it first time when it shows up. Like, I'm only willing to do deals like that with someone that I've, like, had a conversation with, and they seem like a good guy, and, you know, he's taking a risk by bringing it to me. If it's a pile of shit and he shows up with it, and I'm like, no, you know, then.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Nice. Well, I've been, as much as I've been on my deathbed, not to be too dramatic, I've been on my deathbed with a headache and a bad neck. I have been playing with my shitty little CNC a little bit. Just to see what happened. Because I had in the post, we talked about last week, one of those little, the pendant remotes.
Yes, yeah.
So it's just a little USB thing, no configuration at all. Basically, it mimics keystrokes. I'm pretty sure that's all it's doing.
Mark 3.
In Mach 3, exactly. Sorry, yeah. I had a brain fart. And it works really nicely, you know, for jogging around and that kind of thing. And yeah, it works pretty nice. But anyway, all I have been doing with this shitty little CNC is signs. I've made a sign for everything.
Right.
My grinding room now has a sign saying grinding room. The kids' bedroom now has a sign saying their names. We made a sign for the new house. It's just really fun, and it's, you know, it's a really obviously a simple project to do.
It's good practice, though.
It's good practice, especially when you're doing. So for the house sign, for example, I wanted like a 3D carving.
Right.
On there. So it was the first time I've actually done it with a CNC, where I made like a rough-in tool path. Then I made a finer tool path.
Mm.
And it works out really well. And yeah, I'm pretty pleased. So nothing, nice. You know, nothing too technical, but, you know, functional things that are actually being used around the house, which is quite nice.
Nice. Next, you're going to be like that guy on YouTube. How I turned a $1 log into a $12,000 work of art.
Yeah.
I sold $50,000 of signs. Yeah. Such clickbait titles, geez.
Yeah. YouTube seems to be getting worse. I don't know if it's just what I see, but it certainly seems to be getting worse over the last few months. But yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it's just kind of what brings money in, you know? I fight against that really hard. Like, I get people contacting me to do sponsorships and reviews and, you know, they're basically, like, throwing money at you to try and make your channel into their advertising, you know? And I don't want to do it. I really don't. But it is hard, because like I said, like a video that takes like 16 hours to make, you know, and that's just the editing. It can be a bit hard to see the return on that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, whilst we're talking about sort of socials and, you know, YouTube and so on, we've had some questions on Instagram, actually.
Oh, I didn't even check Instagram this week.
Ah.
Bring it on.
Well, we've got some in the notes here. These may be over a week old now, but we haven't answered them yet. So Studio_Blade on Instagram says...
Oh, you haven't read far enough yet, Craig. I added those, and they're not questions.
Aren't they?
No, they're people showing us stuff. It's awesome.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead. Read through that one.
Show us your stuff, Studio Blade. So Studio_Blade on Instagram, doing some really cool work cutting leather with a drag knife on his CNC router. The drag knife is made by Donek Tools, which is donektools.com, and they have a program that will post-process your tool paths to turn them into tool paths suitable for use with the drag knife.
Yeah.
Because we did mention this the other week, didn't we?
Yeah, we were talking about cutting leather, and, you know, when someone says cutting leather on a CNC router, the thing that comes to mind is, like, trying to use an end mill to cut leather.
Yeah.
And as I said, like, that's... I don't think that's a good idea. Don't do it. But then, yeah, Studio Blade on Instagram sent us a DM showing his CNC router cutting leather for sheaths and doing an awesome job of it because he's using a drag knife. So a drag knife is basically like a swiveling X-Acto knife that you put in your spindle. And then as you pull it, as you turn around a corner, the point of the blade is a little bit behind the center of rotation. So it actually turns to keep facing the right way. It looked awesome. Looked great.
That's pretty clever. So the cutting edge is always going to be coming into the material, as opposed to if it was like a mill or something, it would just be rotating. That's cool.
Yeah. So when they say that they have a program to post-process your tool paths, so imagine if you wanted to cut a square with a drag knife, where you try to turn the corner, if you just do a square... then the drag knife's not going to do the right thing. It's going to kind of like fuck up that corner. Yeah. So what it does is like a little outside loop. So it goes, it continues past in a straight line and then it kind of goes up and then comes back down to make that sharp corner by doing an outside loop to allow the drag knife to turn around.
Got you. So just as if you were CNCing with a mill, you could say inside or outside the line and it would do that loop either side.
Yes. That's cool. Yeah. Yeah, so, but, you know, like, it's a pretty inexpensive option. So, yeah, if someone wanted to, like, do a lot of leather or something, then you could totally take, like, a cheap CNC router and then, you know, potentially just use it for drag knife work.
Hmm.
Very handy. It seemed like a really good option.
Yeah. Tech Ingredients, which is a YouTube channel as well. Apparently you've been watching that a lot recently.
I have, yes. So I'm starting on a bit of a crazy project that's not really CNC related. It's automation related, I guess. We've talked a little bit in the past about the DLC coatings on my blade.
Yes, yeah.
So the DLC is basically like it's called diamond-like carbon. So it's basically what they call a PVD coating, a physical vapor deposition coating. So you're kind of chipping atoms off a carbon block and then having them condense onto your blade.
Sounds simple. Sounds really
simple. Yeah, totally simple. The funny thing is that it's actually... some versions of PVD coatings are actually super simple. So if you wanted to do a nickel PVD coating, right? So it's kind of like the PVD equivalent of nickel plating.
Right.
What you would do is you'd put your knife in a really good vacuum chamber, like really, really clean vacuum. And then you would take nickel and heat it up until it's like red hot. And because it's in a vacuum, it evaporates more easily. And when it evaporates, you get little nickel atoms just shooting off in random directions. And then they condense on the first thing that they touch and they stick to it.
Ah.
So okay. You could basically take like a nickel filament, heat it up with an electric current, and have it spray a thin layer of nickel metal all over your blade.
Hmm.
So yeah, like in some ways, it's actually a very, very simple process. So basically, right now my DLC coating is pretty brutal because I have a lot of rejects and rework, and it probably costs me a bit over $30 a knife to do the DLC coating, including all the rework and stuff. So
that is something you can't control yourself as well, isn't that? That's the biggest problem.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm launching into a project to build my own PVD coating system, which is going to be...
You make me laugh.
A lot of fun. It's going to be a lot of fun. I've been kind of lining up on this for a while, learning about it and stuff. But yeah, so there's this YouTube channel called Tech Ingredients, and they just do nuts projects. I think I've talked about them in the past a little bit, where I was watching one of their videos on making rocket engines.
Mm, yes, you did, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so they had another video called Fun with Plasma Tubes, which covers making
Dr.
your
Sheldon own... Sheldon Cooper.
You're right. Yeah, making your own plasma tubes. And accidentally, they're trying to avoid accidentally doing a PVD coating inside their plasma tube. They were sputtering tungsten, which means sputtering means chipping atoms off of the tungsten, and then it's coating onto their glass, which they don't want because they're trying to make a bright light. So yeah, I've been watching a lot of that channel. It's a good time if you're into like physics and chemistry. Good time.
So that's Tech Ingredient. That's the YouTube channel name, is it?
Yeah.
Tech Ingredients.
Yeah, just Tech Ingredients.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, I'm pretty excited about the coating system. Potentially bringing that process into my shop, it would be amazing.
So, I mean, physically, I mean, what sort of size machine is this going to be?
I'm going to build a small one. Like, the guys that do my coatings, their machines are, you know, 8 feet on a side. And once you start getting up into the larger sizes, things just get really complicated because you're not creating pressure in there, you're creating vacuum, but that means that your outside air is exerting inward pressure on your vacuum chamber. And it's about 15 pounds of pressure per square inch. So yeah, you have to build like a pretty beefy vacuum chamber if you want one that's like, you know, 6 feet in diameter. So yeah, I'll be doing it on the cheap. Like I'll be using like a stainless steel cooking pot or something for my final vacuum chamber. It'll be on the smaller side.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've already been building parts. I've been working on the vacuum feed throughs this week, which are ways to get electrical power into the chamber without letting air in or out.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's kind of like a spark plug. You know, spark plug lets you get electricity into an engine without letting the explosions out. The vacuum feed throughs are the same kind of thing for a vacuum chamber, but they're like $200 US each if you just buy them. That's like the cheapest ones.
Yeah.
So I've worked out a way to make them for about $10, which is nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So crazy projects at the moment.
Yes, yeah. When you talk about these things, my mind is just thinking, how and why would you even consider like making something that I don't even understand what it is, let alone how it works?
Well, but that's the thing, like
to have the mindset, or I'll actually just make one anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, so like I wanted to look into nickel coating for my blades for a while because that would be a really great corrosion resistant layer. And there's tons of people on YouTube that are like, oh, you can do nickel coating, it's easy, you know. So I looked at it and then I was like, one of the things they're making is nickel acetate, which is where you, you're basically doing electroplating of nickel into a vinegar bath to make nickel acetate. And then you use that to plate, do the electroplating onto your blade. And then I was like, oh, I should look up, how do you dispose of this stuff? Well, it turns out...
It sounds extremely toxic.
Yeah, turns out it is. And like these guys are just making it on YouTube. No one's talking about how to dispose of it. But it's toxic, carcinogenic, it's a heavy metal salt, which means it's a massive environmental pollutant. Hmm. You know, and I'm sure a lot of these people are just chucking it down the drain.
Oh, geez.
And that's one of the things that really attracts me to the idea of like a PVD coating system, because it's all kind of solid. You know, like at the very worst, you're going to get some like nickel dust out of the system, which is still a very inert, you know? So it's like potentially a very environmentally friendly process. And yeah, if, you know, if you were just to do like nickel or copper or some other metal, then like I said, you're basically just like making a shitty light bulb, right? With your knife inside it.
Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully my videos will make it a lot simpler, make it less magical.
Yes, yeah, and easier to understand, maybe.
Oh, come on, you got it at this point. You just make a shitty
sort of,
light bulb.
Sort of.
Just make a shitty light bulb, Craig. It's not that hard.
Yeah. So could you, rather than coating the whole blade, could you make a fake Damascus by putting the nickel content just on the outside like a sheath?
Yeah, you totally could.
like almost like a Sanmai jacket, which is just the Damascus shapes. Which you could control.
Yes.
With nickel.
Yeah. Especially with the shitty light bulb technique, because it's perfectly line of sight. So you can put a mask in between your blade and the evaporation source. And, you know, just spray the metal on where you want it.
There we go. That's the future.
Yeah.
No more laser engraving required.
Shitty fake Damascus.
One of your machines.
Yeah.
Gothascus, we'll call it. Maybe not. Space news. There's been a lot going on over the last couple of weeks.
Well, wait. Should we talk about space or should we talk about CNC for a minute?
let's Okay, let's talk about CNC for a bit longer, maybe.
For a bit longer. Yeah, so a company called Form Labs, I've been waiting for a long time for them to release their newest 3D printer called the Fuse 1.
Right.
Which is very exciting because it's an SLS printer, so selective laser sintering printer. Yeah,
right. Yeah.
So it prints nylon powder into final nylon parts, and it's super exciting because they were like, "Oh, it's going to be $10,000," and I've been signed up for the mailing list. I've been waiting. They finally released it, and it's $19,000.
Oh.
Yeah, and
wow,
I was like, "Oh." And unfortunately, like, so I was looking into what you need, you know, to be able to run one of those machines. So basically, when you get the parts out of the machine, it's a big block of loose powder with your parts inside it.
Okay. Yeah.
And the powder is ultra fine, like almost like printer toner. So you have to get your parts out of this block of powder without breathing the powder in, without spreading it all over your shop. And it sticks to everything because it's like very staticky. And it's ultra fine. So you kind of need their like special glove box system to even like get the parts out. And that's like another $5,000 or something.
Oh, Jesus.
And then if you want to reuse the powder, you can mix used powder up to 50% with new powder. But then you need the powder recycling system, which is like another $5,000. So... yeah, I was very excited about it, but like it just doesn't seem affordable enough, you know.
Affordable at that price. I mean, SLS. So when I first read this note, I was assuming it was going to be one of the resin printers, which we're seeing quite a lot of.
That's
now.
SLA. stereolithography.
SLA, exactly,
yeah.
Yes. So what's the process with SLS? You say there's this powder, but how is the shape formed?
Yeah, so basically what it does is the printer has a print bed that moves downward. And each time it moves downward, it puts a very thin layer of this plastic nylon powder down. So it lays down a layer of this loose powder. And then it uses a laser to selectively melt or selectively sinter the powder. So it's basically like tracing the shape of each layer onto the powder.
Okay, yeah.
It's just doing that one layer at a time. And then you end up with parts that are like laser melted together inside the loose powder bed. And the reason it's fantastic that it's in the loose powder bed is because you don't need supports ever.
Because it's within the form of it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the loose powder underneath is supporting it. And so that means you can print parts on top of other parts. So the print volume, I think, is about 12 inches square, like cubed. Mm. And you can just fill that with parts.
Wow. So does this need like a heated bed then, or could you essentially just make that gantry as big as you wanted and just print indefinitely?
It doesn't need a heated bed. The build chamber might be lightly heated to make it easier to sinter the material.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But then it has to be like kind of closed off from air because the powder is nylon. And nylon is extremely hydroscopic. It absorbs water really quickly. And when it absorbs water and then you heat it up, it hydrolyzes, which means that it cracks the polymer chains apart and basically ceases to be a useful plastic.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to keep the powder really, really dry, and then it has to be sealed while you're printing it. It's not really a homebrew thing. Like, yes, some people have homebrewed it.
Sounds pretty, yeah. Intensive.
Yeah, some people have homebrewed it, but it's like a pretty brutal process to homebrew a machine like this. Mm. It's potentially super exciting, but still too expensive, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. And what would you want to use that for anyway? What's the...
Sheaths.
Ah, still on the sheaths.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to use it for my sheaths. Mm. We'll see, though. I've still been experimenting on other options, and... a friend of mine in Montreal, Alex, has, so if you look him up on Instagram, it's Alex3DMaker, was kind enough to print me a bunch of samples. He's got a bunch of really nice 3D printers, both resin and filament printers. And he printed me, I think he sent me like 10 samples, different filaments, different resins. So... at some point soon, I'm going to be doing a video showing like my 3D printed sheaths and the ones that he sent me and destruction testing of all of them. And just like talking about the different materials and stuff. So we'll see. I would love to 3D print my sheaths. I'm not sure if it's going to happen, but I'm looking at it.
Yeah. Well, what was the update after with the luminescent handles? have you put those into sort of production? Have any shipped?
I've shipped a couple, actually. Nice. I still have to work on that a little bit. So, yeah, Craig's referring to, I did some glow-in-the-dark handle scales, which was awesome. So I was mixing a really high-performance glow-in-the-dark powder with some epoxy and pigments so that it has a really nice daytime color. It's like a really bright green. Mm. And then basically machining a pocket into the underside of some G10 so that it acts as a mold and I can actually like pour it straight onto the G10, let it cure and then machine the whole block. Overall it's worked really well. I think the powder that I'm using is too coarse because it's settling out of the epoxy too much.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so basically I want it to stay in suspension, but the epoxy that I'm using cures really slowly. It takes like 72 hours to cure. And it's very low viscosity. And the reason that that's important is because it means it kind of self-releases any bubbles that might be in the epoxy. But that also means the powder has a ton of time to settle. So I actually bought a mortar and pestle. I'm going old school. I'm going to grind some powder up and see how that goes.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
And could you potentially use these for liners then? Could you machine them to, you know, sort of 2, maybe 3 mil?
Yeah, well, that's what I've been doing. I've been basically taking the G10, machining like a 2 millimeter deep pocket, or it's actually like 1 millimeter. It's like 60 thou. one millimeter deep pocket in the backside of it, and then pouring the glow-in-the-dark epoxy right into that pocket.
Right, okay, yeah.
And then curing it, and then I machine the whole thing, and that layer basically comes out as the liner for the knife.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it looks awesome. I'm genuinely thinking about my black and green handle scales, so the black scales with the green liners. I'm thinking about moving to doing all of those in the glow-in-the-dark material.
Oh, wow.
Because it basically looks exactly the same in the daylight, and then at nighttime it has an awesome glow effect to it. So,
because that's been the biggest problem that I've seen plenty of these glow-in-the-dark scales available sort of commercially.
Yeah, and they look shit during the day, right?
It's like this milky sort of off-white. Almost like jade. They tried to say it looks like jade, but it's that kind of color, but there's no sort of quality to it. It's not nice.
Yeah, so I've done a couple with a Ghost Jade G10, like natural G10, which is kind of transparent, and then the kind of bright green layer on the inside of it gives it like a candy apple green kind of color.
Yeah,
and then it glows through the G10 as well. And that looks cool. Like I like that a lot. It's a little bit more gimmicky because it's really obvious that it's like a glow in the dark thing, you know, but it you can see it all night. Like it's very, very practical in that way.
Nice.
It's been fun.
I bet. Well, I'm still sort of working on this folded knife. And I've been using Alpharin for it, which is I don't want to say fake ivory, but it's what would be the right word to use? Synthetic, I suppose. Synthetic.
Right.
And I'm sort of in two minds whether to be using it or not, because it clearly isn't real ivory, but it's trying to be ivory, you know. And whether that's, you know, it's like people wearing fake fur. It's still not quite right. It's almost endorsing.
No, I think it's fine. I think that's fine. I think fake fur is fine too. You know, like I think it's a step into. I think it's a step of progress, right? Like there's clearly something useful about fur. Otherwise, we wouldn't want it.
Yeah, you know? But I think to the person who doesn't know what material you're using, you're just wearing fur, and you're sort of normalizing wearing fur again. Or in this case, it would be ivory. He just normalizing using ivory,
right?
Again.
Yeah,
so
I get that.
That's my sort of thing with it. So I have actually got an alternative as well. So I'm going to be offering the folding knife with two different materials for scales. So one is just solid brass.
Okay.
And it looks super, super cool. So it just looks like a little bar of brass.
Right.
That you carry. Obviously, brass isn't the hardest stuff. So over time, it's going to get, you know, little nicks and little sort of wear patches on there.
And it'll take on a nice patina from handling too.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be pretty cool. So yeah, there's going to be the two, but yeah, I'm thinking maybe a glow in the dark special edition could be pretty cool too. But that's the thing, when I come up with like a new design or a new product kind of thing, I'm always telling myself keep it simple. Don't offer anything. It is what it is.
Right.
Because the moment you start offering sort of the customizations, that's when it takes the time and when it becomes difficult.
Yeah.
So at first it was just going to be, right, it's just this synthetic ivory handle and that's it. Then it's like, okay, well, the brass as well. So that's one option. And now I'm talking potentially a third option. It's just like,
right,
calm down. Power it back a bit again, I think. I think that's the way forward.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I'm looking at the moment is going open season on my color combinations, like allowing people to order, you know, sort of for a small upcharge, like $25 or something, allowing people to order whatever color combo they want.
Yeah, and could they configure that on the website then as well?
Yeah.
Nice.
And yeah, basically, I've been having to try and work out how to do that, and that's been something that I've wanted to do for a long time. And I think basically what I'm going to do is, so whenever I'm doing handle materials, I cut them up on I have a diamond tile saw, and I use that to cut up the G10 because it keeps there's dust like no down. Dust, yeah, which is really nice. So I cut them into blocks that are 1.5 inches wide by 10.5 inches long. And that's the right size to go straight into the CNC for machining into handle scales. Yeah. But normally, before I cut them up, I laminate the liners and the handle scales together. So you get like the green liner on the black handle scales or whatever.
So machining all as one then.
Yeah. And I think basically what I'm going to do is start stocking the thicker part, so like the actual scale and the liner separately, but they'll all be cut up to the right size. And then I bought a block of ultra high molecular weight polyethylene, which is a really slippery white plastic, almost like Teflon, but harder. I'm going to make this jig where you slot the liner and the handle scale in together with glue in between them. And then there's just like a little clamping system that comes down. So I'll be able to just, you know, on demand kind of glue up individual blocks of material for the handle scales. And then, you know, 2 hours later, they'll be ready to machine.
So is this material sort of resistant to epoxy then? You can just peel that off.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so any squeeze out will just get kind of squished up against, there'll be like a channel cut into the polyethylene that'll be exactly the right size for the handle scales. Any squeeze out of the glue will just get kind of squished onto the sides, and then the whole thing will just peel out.
Smart.
So, well, it'll be smart if it works. We have to try it first. Maybe I'll glue a bunch of handle scales into this fucking block of plastic, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that that would speed up my process hugely because, let's say, like, my camp knife comes with two different sort of liners, I suppose.
Right.
Like you just said, it's much harder to do them separately.
Yes.
Simply because, you know... If they're machined to size or they're ground down to size, matching them perfectly is difficult because the minute you put pressure on them, you know, epoxy wants to slide around and you know, it's not the best. But what I have been using are have you heard of Cant Twist? They're little clamps.
Yeah.
But they don't give that sort of rotational
They're used a lot for welding and machining.
Exactly. Yes. Yep. Yeah. On this sort of rig that you're making, using those sort of clamps would stop any sort of slide around as well.
I'm actually going to use fixture clamps, so that it's like a cam operated clamp with like a toggle clamp.
Yeah.
That just comes straight down, and so they'll actually be like fixed permanently into the ultra high molecular weight polyethylene block. So they'll be in the right... That's a mouthful, isn't it?
It is. So
they'll be always in the right spot. Theoretically, I should be able to do like 5 or 6 handle scales at a time. And then, you know, they'll be ready a couple of hours later.
Nice.
We'll see. I've got the parts for that sitting there. It's been, you know, I've been meaning to do it for like 2 months.
So you could just like a bin full of all your different colors and so on and just make them to order and send them out Amazon style next day.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, when we were talking about lean manufacturing last week, like, that's a very lean process. That, you know, just-in-time assembly of handle scale material, that's a very lean improvement. So, yeah, I'm excited about that. It's going to be a nice little improvement.
Yeah. Here's the thing, right? If you get a request for, I don't know, something that you just know will be ugly, brown liners and a... And a pink handle. Are you going to be happy making that, or are you going to be like, I don't know.
You know, because like that knife that we were talking about before, that was like blue with the green liners. Mm. I thought that was going to be ugly. You know, in my head, I hadn't put it together with the knives that I'd seen Jeff made that look really good. You know,
yeah.
I thought it was going to be ugly, and I was surprised. So, I don't know.
Cause it's one of those things, isn't it? Once your knife is out there, you know, people are showing their friends and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if it's something that you think is ugly, yeah, you're sure their friends are going to go, oh, geez.
Okay, so the ugliest knife that I've ever made was a request from a guy in Russia, and it was asymmetrical. It was one handle scale bright orange, one handle scale bright green.
Oh, okay. Well, funnily enough, Jeff is doing a lot of them at the moment, too, of that kind of thing.
But just the orange and green, no, it didn't.
It's a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's because, I mean, you come from a software background as well. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at some of my older knives, and I look back through, like, pictures of, you know, the first knives that I did, I'm like...
Right.
Oh man, these are sitting in people's drawers. The people are using these. I was thinking, I wish I could just send, like, an update. You know, it's like a software update.
Right.
Then up to my current standard, because, I shudder thinking about some of the knives I've sent out in the past, which at the time I thought were great. But, you know, as you get better at things,
But you know what? That's a good sign. There's the people that look back on their work from 5 years ago and are still happy with it, they're not improving.
Yes, maybe. Yeah.
You know, it's a good sign that you shudder, you know, and I do the same, but you know, that's a good thing, man.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of conversations that I have with people, like customers from years ago, you know, where they're, you know, we're just chatting on the internet or something like that. They'll say something and I'm like, oh yeah, Jesus, I remember that knife. And I'm like trying to steer the conversation to something else quickly. Because,
right.
Right. One of those things. We all improve over time, I suppose.
Yeah. And I mean, I think ultimately that like a lot of people just really want to have like a fully customized thing. They want it to be theirs. Mm. And I respect that. So who knows? Like my uncle, is a cabinet maker, and he paints all of his tools like fluorescent pink, like a really horrible fluorescent pink, just with a rattle can,
yeah,
you know, with a spray can, and he doesn't try to do a good job on it, and it really clearly identifies his tools as his, and they're also ugly that no one wants to steal them.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
You know?
I like that my tools to be like clean.
Yes.
And, you know, to stay remaining new as possible, as long as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I'm like the only person that, like, you know, takes a damp rag to their shop vacs and cleans them, you know.
I'm not quite that bad, but it's only since, you know, I used to be the guy who'd buy, like, the cheapest tools to get the job done.
Right.
But then you find that, you buy another cheap tool, and it's that whole sort of, you know.
Yeah.
You know, buy quality, buy once kind of thing, you know. And
buy
and
once,
since
cry
started,
once, I say.
Yeah, yeah. Since I started doing that, I don't know, I just gained a much more sort of respect for the tools that I've got and look after them far, far more.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of in the middle ground. Like, if I'm buying something that I, you know, I'm going to need very rarely. So, like, in the old shop, I needed a hammer drill.
Hmm.
And, like, not one of those piss-weak little, you know, oh, it's a hammer drill, it's a driver, it's a, you know, I needed like a proper hammer drill.
The 9-volt battery, yeah.
Yeah, none of that. So, you know, I was looking at hammer drills, like SDS drills, and if you want like a Makita SDS hammer drill, you know, it's like $600.
Yeah.
And I'm never going to get $600 worth of use out of it. So I bought, you know, a Skill brand SDS drill, plugs into the wall, you know, it has a ton of power. It was like $120, and you know what? I'm totally going to get $120 worth of use out of its lifetime.
Yeah,
but I'm going to use it like four times a year or something, you know?
That's the way to think of it, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I but if it's stuff that you use every day, yeah, you don't want to be getting the cheap stuff.
No. So let's talk about space. We do it every week. We do, a lot has happened over the last, since we last spoke.
Yeah.
You know, even I'm aware of the stuff that's been. I don't follow space too, you know, too keenly.
What has been happening, Craig?
Well, there's the rover that landed on Mars.
Yeah.
Which sent images extremely quickly. Yeah. Which think of like that as a feat, you know, as you know of what humankind can do. I'm sitting there and I'm watching on my little phone on this little magic device. And I'm watching almost in as real time as you can get, I suppose, considering something touching down on Mars, and you're wondering like, you know, what's it going to see? What's it going to? It blows my mind. And just this week, so at the NASA site, they've always got stuff on there, obviously. But there was a live stream, and there's these two people doing a spacewalk, and you know, it was just a link on Twitter. I clicked it, and next, you know, I'm watching like in close to real time. These people just, you know, doing a spacewalk, and they're doing some sort of maintenance. And you're just thinking,
right,
Jesus, that's happening now. This isn't science fiction. This is like real on my phone, which is science fiction in itself. But yeah, it just blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, the one, like, I think it's amazing too. The thing that bugs me is just that I know that rover was made at like an exorbitant cost. Like, just way, way too high. Like, I honestly, so the company that launched it, ULA, the United Launch Alliance, they kind of pissed me off because they're what's called a cost plus contractor, which means that like however much it costs them, that's what NASA pays plus plus a bit, you know, plus some profit. Yeah. So if they take twice as long just because, and it costs twice as much just because, that like that's what NASA has to pay.
Yeah. Wow.
So unfortunately, like that little helicopter that went up to Mars as part of the Perseverance program, apparently that was like $80 million.
Oh.
Right. Like, so I love the idea. I just it irks me a bit that, you know, I really like the way that SpaceX do things, right? Like, they're not afraid to, you know, blow shit up in the name of like eventually getting it done with an overall much lower cost.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of would have loved to have seen a SpaceX version of the Mars rover.
NASA need to be working with, like, with brands. Get like Land Rover involved and say, look, we'll use this external company to make this rover. We'll stick a Land Rover badge on the front and you pay half the bill. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I don't know. I'm torn in between two things, right? Like I really think space exploration should be like a non-profit, non-advertising thing. But I think it should also be done with like a modicum of cost reasonability, you know, like
yeah
but yeah, it's amazing. Like, it's very, very cool. I don't know why it bugs me. It's a hot take, I know, but it bugs me a little bit.
Yeah There was also I saw a tweet and I don't know which company it was that are working on it, but the hotel in space, which they reckon by the end of 2023 will be taking bookings.
You read press releases and you just take them at face value, don't you?
Completely. Yeah. Yeah. But it
looked, I don't know if you saw the press release where I said I was going to launch a knife to Jupiter. 100%. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Space hotel.
They didn't mention how you'd get up there, how, you know, what the travel arrangements are. But it looked very, very cool.
Yeah, I just imagine like they're gonna be sending a lot of really space sick people up there, you know. You'll be in a hotel with 20 other people that are trying to have space sex, getting like massive motion sickness, puking their guts out in a zero g environment.
Oh Jesus,
it's gonna be a floating puke
just
hotel
all over the place, just flying and, through the air.
Yeah, exactly. It's gonna be horrible.
Yeah, well, the porn industry, it does seem to be sort of leading the way in technology, has done for years.
Porn, you think that's next?
So maybe, yeah, that's what'll happen. They'll be filming up there before anything else. God.
You had to talk about space, didn't you, Craig?
We had to. It's a weekly thing. It's a weekly thing.
Yeah.
I've got a few links here that we, I think... Certainly for the first one, we talked about something the other week and we didn't really mention the link to it. Which was ArcWelder, which was a software for producing smoother, faster, and better 3D prints.
Yes, very clever little thing this, actually. So I didn't realize that most 3D printing software, like your slicer, is actually, you know, so if you have like a big circle, it's actually spitting out, you know, 1,000 little straight line segments. And that's not really something that's done with CNC machines because it would look horrible. But I didn't realize that that's kind of the norm in 3D printing. And apparently, like Marlin, which is one of the most common 3D printer firmwares for like actually running your 3D printer, has support for native arcs. So in the G-code, you can program a circle. Right, but like almost no one uses it. Which is really interesting. So ArcWelder is a little bit of software that post-processes your G-code. So you could use like Prusa Slicer or Cura or whatever. Make your, slice your file, make your 3D print G-code, and then run it through ArcWelder. And what it'll do is actually detect when a whole bunch of straight lines are supposed to be an arc, and then just turn it into an arc.
Okay. So think of that as... I don't know, like an illustration terms, as like working with a bitmap or working with like an SVG.
Yeah, so taking your having... pixels and making it into a vector, into a smooth line.
Yes, yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and apparently there's actually like a non-trivial improvement in like the final quality of the prints, particularly if you're printing like a big round thing, like if you're printing like a vase or something. A lot of the time you'll see those big circles come out with like little facets on a regular 3D printer, and then Arc Welder basically eliminates that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it also can significantly increase the printer's speed, because rather than having to like read 1,000 lines of code to make one circle, it's basically just reading one.
Yeah.
So in some ways it makes it a lot easier on the 3D printer. So, and the movement's much smoother because the 3D printer knows it's trying to make a circle rather than trying to make a, you know, 1,000 stop start lines. So yeah, I just thought that was really clever. Like if you're, you know, struggling with getting like really nice flowing curves on a 3D print, then yeah, this program called Arc Welder might be the thing to look at.
Cool. And there's a video on YouTube demonstrating this as well, so I'll make sure to put that in the show notes so people can just go and take a look.
Yep, 100%.
And the last point that we've got here in our notes is about recycling plastic. And I know we're both very sort of keen on this because, you know, it's something that we all should be keen about. But, you know, we talked about using a recycled material for sheaths last week.
Yep.
And, our shops, we're trying to make a sort of... We're trying to be as responsible makers, basically, and, you know, waste as little as possible.
Yeah, as much as we can.
Well, yeah, exactly. And this is a Wikipedia entry, and saying that in 2018, only 8.5% of all plastic used in the US was recycled.
Yeah.
8.5%.
And I knew it was bad, I just didn't know it was that bad.
And yeah, when I ran across that, I was like, stuff that we... I mean, particularly here and the UK as well, and I'm not sure how it is in the US or in Canada. We have like multiple, you know, bins for putting our rubbish into. So whether it's, you know, non-recyclable or if it is recyclable and all the rest of it. But I know that even the recyclable stuff that's taken away, it is only a small percentage of that is recycled, because it can be, you know, if it's not 100% clean, they'll just literally toss it back into the garbage. They won't clean it before recycling.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. They blame consumers for that stuff. They're like, you have to clean your plastic, you know. But even on the stuff that is clean, only a very small percentage of it is recycled. Because, you know, so in Canada, it's kind of funny. They use like computer vision systems for sorting some of the recycling. But the conveyor belts that they have all the plastic on are black, and that means that they cannot recycle any black plastic.
Yes, yeah, and I've heard something about the pigment that's used in black plastic as well. That's problematic. So I don't think it's just the actual scanning. I think the actual material for some reason as well.
I mean, it definitely means you can't use it in any other colors, because I think it's normally just like a carbon black that's the pigment. So it's black regardless of how much you dilute it.
Yeah.
But yeah, just, I don't know, I read that, it just kind of bums me out, you know? Like,
yeah, it is just a horrible statistic, because
fuck, you know,
people are trying to do their best, and you think you're doing such a good thing by reducing your waste and having more sort of recyclables, but if only a small percentage of that is actually being recycled, it's just a kick in the nuts.
Yep, good old running kick too.
Yeah. But funnily enough, just this morning, let me pull it up, it was... a company contacted me because they'd read on my website. I've got like a sustainability policy on my website for CHOP. And there's a company that contacted me. And let me find out who they were just a second.
Well, I also saw a really interesting company. I saw an ad for them, of all things. They're called CERT, C-E-R-T.
Right.
And they're... So one of the issues with plastics recycling is that every time you reheat it and you remelt it, you're like recrystallizing it, you're like rearranging the structure, and you're basically making it worse every time you do that. It's losing its mechanical properties and so on. So what they're doing is actually, they've developed a process to like burn the plastic in a very specific way in like a sealed system so that it produces ethylene gas. And ethylene gas is one of the primary ingredients in polyethylene. It's polymerized ethylene. So by being able to produce the gas, like the precursor gas, they're able to produce virgin plastic again, rather than remelting it. They're actually like making it into completely new plastic.
Yeah.
So I haven't really read anything about that other than just seeing the ad. But it was one of the few ads on YouTube that actually like, oh, I actually watched it.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've just pulled up actually. The company reached out to me. It was called Pak Urang.
Okay.
Again, we put the link in the show notes there. So basically, it's about reusing the packaging. So. They've got this whole big spiel about, you know, Amazon boxes and so on. They're never reused and hardly recycled.
Yep.
But these things, they're more like a shopping bag that you'd keep using and using and using. And the whole point of this is that you'd ship your products in these bags. And whichever shipping company you use to deliver, there's an incentive for them to come and pick it back off you. So next time they give you a package, they'll say, have you got your old package in? And they'll take it. And this stuff doesn't need any sort of process to be recycled. They literally just take the label off, stick a new label on, and it's ready to be used again.
Oh, weird.
It's a really nice idea. Pak Urang. But, you know, it's one of those things that will only work if lots of people do it, because a lot of people think, well, what the hell is this? You know, what are we going to do with this?
It's like the old school... like milk delivery services where, yes, you know, they didn't smash your bottle up and recycle it every time. They just reused the bottle.
Reused the actual bottle. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, again, it was another tweet actually that I saw. We spent a lot of time in bed reading tweets. and somebody said, like, imagine a future where, you know, 90% of the traffic on the roads, is particularly early mornings, was electric. They'd be delivering products that were in packaging that was fully recyclable. And it's like, that's exactly what, I don't know if you had it in the US, but certainly in the UK, we had milkmen in the morning. Mm-hmm. They deliver milk on electric cars.
Yeah, and their little electric milk vans.
Yeah, back in the sort of 70s, you know, they'd have these little electric carts and they'd come, they'd deliver, you know, milk bottles made of glass, delivered to your doorstep. And then, yeah, you know, the next day they'd give you more, they'd take away the old milk, they'd wash that, reuse them, and that kind of thing. And it's very sort of, you know, you can imagine a tech startup now going, this is brilliant, on demand, and we'll deliver to you the next day, and we'll take away your packaging. And it's like, well, it's been done before.
Man, I would sign up for that in a heartbeat. If, like, every morning you got, you know, fresh milk, fresh bread.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's nothing better than, like, brand new bread, brand new milk, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yeah,
I remember as a kid as well, when the milk was delivered as a kid, because they were in these glass bottles, you know, they'd have been normally sort of like 3 and 4 in the morning, you'd hear the little electric cart going around and all the milk bottles rattling away. But in the morning then you'd pick it up and like the top of the milk bottle would have like the cream, you know, and it would like be quite thick.
Right.
It's like, oh, just the best.
So it's real milk. None of this stuff we get now.
Yes,
yeah.
Proper, straight from the cow. Straight from the tit.
Yeah, idolizing the past now, right? I don't know, man. I don't know what the solution is, but I just read that and I was just like, oh, bummed me out.
Yeah, yeah.
And on that note, we're going to leave you all bummed out for the whole day.
Have a good think about your recycling, kids.
Yeah, I think, as you said, as makers, as people that make stuff, I think it is important to think about our waste products, you know, what stuff can be reused, what stuff can't.
Yeah, but we're all part of the problem. If we're making stuff, we're making waste and we're using energy and so on. But the idea is to cut down as much as possible and make things that will last forever. I think that's probably the biggest thing we could do.
Mm-hmm.
Making stuff that's not going into the ground and having to remake again. But
one thing I'd really like to try, so I mean, I'm living in the city now, so this isn't really practical, but I'm planning to move outside the city, get a bit of a bigger shop. And one thing I really want to try is doing in-house recycling of my steel. So remelting it or, you know, forge welding it into a new block to remachine. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, that sounds like a really fun project.
Yeah, but I use exclusively now Sandvik steels.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got an incredible sort of sustainability policy and, you know, looking to the future, what they plan on doing. But at the moment, their stainless 12C27, which is, used massively over here in Europe.
Right.
I suppose it's AEBL, very similar. It is 78% recycled at the moment.
Right.
Which is incredible. And also their whole sort of delivery method, everything is, they think of everything, you know, and yeah, they really seem to have their head screwed on. And their sustainability policy, which you can download online, is just done brilliantly. And it's actually readable, unlike many of those policies you see elsewhere. So yeah, I'm a big fan of Sandvik stuff. And yeah.
Nice. Well, I've been trying to talk to them in North America. And as I said to you previously, I haven't had much luck. So I'm going to reach out to the European Sandvik, see what it's like.
Yeah, well, over here, it's the steel of choice, really. Everybody seems to be using Sandvik.
Right.
As I say, it's just very common over here.
Yeah, whereas in North America, it's like, no one uses it.
Right.
Pretty much. Like, you know, some people use AEBL, which often comes from Uddeholm, and then there's 13C26, which comes from Sandvik. Hmm. But, yeah, getting 13C26 here is... I don't think I've seen anyone that's selling Sandvik 13C26.
Right.
I think, wow. What's it called? Empire Steels, something like that. I think they have 12C27 and 14C28.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's, I'm trying to remember the name of this company, but I've unfortunately heard some bad things about them, so.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, like substituting steels for other steels.
Ah.
Without telling the customer and that kind of stuff, you know. So I'm like, oh,
that's not good.
Yeah,
that's not good. Yeah, we're straying into knife talk territory here.
Yep, that's right. Get a bit of everything on this one.
That's a show. That's a show. We shall speak to you all again next week.
Have a great week, everyone.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.